So human beings are so creative and so multifaceted that there are many perspectives we can use to understand our life. And a great pleasure sometimes is to acquire a new perspective that shatters the old one and we see fresh and new. And over time, that one becomes limiting. And then we're maybe ready for a new one. Or in the context of the deeper Dharma, we're perhaps ready for the absence of perspective. But that'll come in due time. And one of the perspectives that's been very recurrent in Western Buddhism, that I think is emphasized much more here than in Asia, probably because it represents good medicine for people in this culture. And that is the language of the perspectives that have something to do with just being, not doing, arriving, Nikki talked about in the beginning, or just here, as I talked about. And there's a well-worn expression in American Buddhism that is like being no one, doing nothing, going nowhere. And for some people, this perspective is such a huge relief. It's also a wonderful perspective to help us really be in the present moment, the work of which is to understand all the ways that we are not in the present moment. And we have tremendous creativity for not being present. There's infinite number of wonderful and terrible things to consider in the future, what might happen, planning and fantasy and all kinds of things. And, you know, if you like that kind of thing, there's no shortage of things you could think about. You can go on for to the day you die, the breath you die, all the things you could think about that are ahead of you. And there's no shortage of things to think about in the past. Reviewing the past, redoing the past. No shortage of fantasies, conversations to be had, great American novels to write, lyrics to do. You know, we're quite capable. And some of that distracting or moving out or thinking a lot or being caught up in these kinds of thoughts are motivated or powered by deep needs that we have. So we're trying to get our needs met. We're trying to help ourselves become safe. We're trying to deal with a legacy, perhaps, of grief and hurt sometimes with a legacy of unmet needs that we've had in our life and that are still kind of there and bubbling up. And so as we learn to not be so distracted from the present moment, perhaps because we've learned that being elsewhere is overrated, that it's actually a truncated life to spend too much time in fantasy and stories and thoughts. And so we begin to kind of come back and arrive and be here. And it's not an easy thing to do because it takes a lot of familiarity with all the things that are the reasons why we're not here. Sometimes here is not safe for people. It's not pleasant. It's uncomfortable. So we're learning, sometimes courageously, to face this stuff, to show up here, to work through the things, and just to arrive. And it's a lot of wisdom, personal wisdom, a lot of wisdom about life, comes from really being mature and upright, about really fessing up, really looking at what's really happening here. And settling through it, kind of like settling through layers. And as many of you maybe know, I love, for the time being, the metaphor of going deep. So going deeper and deeper. So you're coming deeper and deeper inside. And so one of the very meaningful perspectives for me for this process is that of coming home. to really feel at home here. So the heart is at home in itself. So really kind of settled and at peace. And that's very meaningful. And I've tasted things like that, and it's been very meaningful to do. And these kind of perspectives, as useful as they are, have their limitation. And one of them is that it's kind of static. There is maybe movement inward to come here, but the end result is kind of like static, just being, you know? And so sometimes people get the impression from this kind of language that nothing's really supposed to happen. That nothing's, you know, you're supposed to just kind of just be better here. So if you're suffering, you just suffer better, you know, because you're supposed to be here fully, you know, and that's it. To be kind of, you know, extreme with how it might be interpreted. So as far as I can tell, the Buddha did not use much this metaphor of coming home so much, or of just being here in the same way that's emphasized, so much is emphasized here. He could, perhaps, but the movement to what he wants, what Buddha, his metaphors, what he used, his language, his perspective, and this perspective of just being, the work is very much the same. The work is working through the hindrances, working through the distraction, all these forces, all these difficult aspects of our life that as we go through the layers, if you follow Gill, you go down. And someone else might say that's going outward, you know, so freeing the boundaries and just going further and further out. Or some people might say they're getting high. And but the work is very much the same. If we look at the ancient teachings of the Buddha, it seems that the metaphor, the perspective for practice that he seems to specialize in, and as in fact it's kind of the way he sees most things, is in terms of movement. So, you know, the metaphor of the path is a movement along a path. The metaphor of a stream is moving down a stream. And and he talks about the Dharma being onward leading. It kind of goes someplace. And this idea that the Dharma, this is very inspiring for some people, that it's onward leading, it leads somewhere. You're entering into a path, you're entering into a flow, you're entering into a momentum that's going someplace that's actually quite meaningful and important. And that practice is not so much about just being here. The practice is kind of like moving forward. To bring those two together, those two kind of ideas, it's to move forward into the next present moment. You know, so it's not like moving forward away from here, but it's moving forward to the next here. It's always moving into the time, they say, is always moving, right? The current of time, the river of time. And so we're kind of moving, you know, so say movement going on the path, moving along. So I bring this up in talking about the topic today, which is the equanimity factor of awakening. There are 7 factors of awakening. And these factors of awakening are I think of them as being in the domain of the movement of practice, in the domain of doing the practice. It's possible to look at equanimity from so many different perspectives. It's possible to look upon it in terms of our relationships and to ourselves and to other people, and do equanimity brahmaviharas and learn to be equanimous about some of the difficulties that exist in our social world, maybe. It's possible to look at it from the point of view of, you know, everyday life and our difficulties and challenge we have at work or whatever, and being more equanimous with it. But when we look at equanimity through the perspective of the 7 factors of awakening, I associate with really, this is now we're talking about how equanimity comes into play as we do the meditation practice, as we do our walking practice and our sitting practice. And it has a kind of particular focus. And these 7 factors come together, and work together to move, to be this onward leading movement, to move onward. And the analogy I have for this movement is, if you think of the seven factors of awakening to be like a boat going through the water. And if a boat's going to go through the water, you know, it has this pointed front, bow, and it just kind of plows through the water, and it doesn't stop for the water. What it does is allows the water just to wash off to the side, to the hull, and leaves it behind. It just kind of plows ahead. And so for us, there's a way in which we do this mindfulness practice, showing up, concentration practice, being here with our experience. And it can be useful maybe to have this analogy that you're actually a boat, and you're heading ahead. The goal is to be free. The beacon up ahead is your capacity to be free. And you're heading through the water to it, and you're going to let all kinds of things just wash off to the side. You're not going to stop for it. I've been out in boats in the ocean, and there's leaves on the ocean and twigs and, you know, things floating there. And if they're small enough, the boat just kind of, the pow just goes towards it, and it just, you know, comes off the side and comes off the side. And the boat doesn't, and certainly it doesn't stop for the water. And, you know, it's just, so in the same way, we can just kind of go into the next moment, following the path, the current forward, and let a lot of things just fall off to the side. Just let it go. It's not worth picking up. You don't have to stop for it. The bumper sticker, maybe for Vipassana practitioners, is I don't stop for the hindrances. I don't stop for fantasy. I don't stop for the past. I don't stop for the future. These kind of thoughts and ideas and things can come up, but there's a wise way, if you're able to do this and really kind of stay in the current or stay in the water and not stop, it's just let it fall away. And I say that because a lot of us can have the idea, we have learned growing up, that certain things are so important, they have to be addressed. And then we've come to Buddhism in America, and here in America we've learned we're not supposed to do spiritual bypasses, you're supposed to turn towards everything, and sometimes that just means you stop for everything, you stop the boat. If the boat is stopped already, then figure out what's going on. Maybe you have to pay attention, maybe you're aground someplace in a sandbar, sandbar of desire or the sandbar of ill will or something. And so you have to kind of, you know, then you have to kind of figure out what to do and be with it. But if there's no sandbar, if just water, and a lot of our thoughts are just like, they're so insubstantial. Our thoughts are like the lightest, one of the lightest things in the universe. Have you ever thought about the weight of a thought? You know, and it's like, it doesn't even exist as much as a hologram exists. You know, it's just like, where is it? You know, this thought image, you know, it's like light and has no substance. And it's possible to invest it with so much importance. And we've been trained by our society and all kinds of places to give these thoughts and ideas so much importance, so much weight. One of the things that happens as we move forward, move on in the practice, our thinking becomes lighter and lighter, thinner and thinner, weaker and weaker. It doesn't necessarily stop, but they don't have the weight and the like a hammer, or it's like, you know, it's not like, you know, this, we're not invested so much in it. And it's quite lovely to have our thoughts get thinner and thinner and thinner, lighter and lighter. And it's, but you know, you don't have to stop for everything if you're able to keep the boat going through the water. So the seven factors of awakening as part of the practice is what helps give this continuity to the boat. It gives us an ability to really stay there and onward leading, stay there, stay there, stay there. And don't stop. If you don't like this kind of a movement, idea of movement, you can use the analogy of standing still with an umbrella in the rain. you know, you won't get wet. The water just washes right off the umbrella. And so these thoughts, all kinds of things can just wash off. And you don't necessarily doing a spiritual bypass, you're not necessarily avoiding things to do that. It might actually be the opposite. By continually to stop for so many thoughts, concerns, ideas, feelings that we have, we actually might be shortchanging ourselves from seeing the magnitude of who we are, for experiencing the fullness of who we are, experience the beauty of who we are, experiencing the full potential of freedom that we are, that we have. And so, where do you want this ship to go? I think in the language of the Buddha, we're always moving, and you have a choice which direction you go. And you can go one direction, you can go down into the hindrances, into the defilements, into preoccupation, into suffering. And there's another way to go, which is on this great boat, this great, wonderful, you know, state-of-the-art, ultra-beautiful boat. And that's the seven factors of awakening. And so it starts with mindfulness. It starts with showing up, being attentive. If you're going to guide a boat through the water, you have to be very attentive, very present. I'll tell you a sailing story. When I was, I think I was 19 or 20, I was a sailboat that went across the Atlantic. And it was before they had automatic steering wheels in boats. So we had to be on the helm 24 hours a day. And so I was on watch, what we called it, you know, on three times a day for 2 hours. In the middle of the night, the morning, and the afternoon. And I had decided at the beginning of that summer that it was okay to have a fantasy life. So you can imagine this was a beautiful place in middle Atlantic, endless sky, endless sea, great to fantasize, just let it go. And I was often alone at the middle of the night, stars and everything. And but I had to hold the helm, the steering wheel of the boat. And I had to look at the compass, I had to look at the sails. And it was a little bit, you know, you had to, you know, it was challenging to sail. You know, you could easily have all kinds of problems could arise if you went off course. And there were big waves. And so if you went off course, the waves would bash you about. So you had to really stay on course. And so here I was, giving this freedom to my mind to do what it did. And every second or so, I had to check in with reality. I had to be steering the boat, looking at the compass, looking at the sails, looking at the waves. I was constantly having to check into reality. So what I didn't know was that because I was doing that, I gave freedom to my mind, and I didn't give in to anything. I didn't chase or follow those thoughts, those fantasies, because I had to constantly be in reality, be here, be present, had to be aware. By the end of the summer, the crossing of the Atlantic, I was more ecstatic than I'd ever been in my life before. And I attributed to those 6 hours a day of just being in the present moment. And I wasn't letting go of my thoughts. I didn't have to do the work of letting go of it. I didn't know I was supposed to let go of it, but I was just kind of going ahead into the present, into the present, into the present, and all those thoughts just washed off my personal hull. They just washed off. They didn't stick anywhere. I didn't stop for them. And it was quite a lovely lesson for me. So when I started meditating, that was kind of a reference point for me of what to do in meditation, to give freedom, certain kind of freedom to my mind, but keep staying in reality. So these things would just wash off. There wouldn't be a problem, I just let them wash off the hull. So to show up and be aware of the reality of what's here. Just be present, be present. Hold the course of being present. Keep coming back. And then the second factor of awakening is called, usually it's called in English, investigation. It more literally means to discern, distinguish what's actually going on here. Distinguish the mental qualities that are useful and not so useful. So as you're going along on your boat, you recognize that if you're really lost in daydream, that big wave behind you is going to let you know that you just messed up. Because what it was really something that if we got caught the wrong way, it would like we turn 90 degrees on a dime on a boat, like taking a car and making a sharp turn, skidding. It was quite really harrowing. Oh, I wasn't in reality. I wasn't present. I had to, you know, to follow it, these big waves. And I had to really discern, am I preoccupied with something? Am I angry at something and caught in that? Am I desiring something and caught in that? You have to stay, to see what you're doing, distinguish, be able to recognize, are you present? Are you present? Are you not present? Are you present? Distinguish between all the different aspects of what it's like to be present and be not present. And over time, we get better and better at recognizing what that's like. One of the things that I learned to recognize is what happens to the body when I'm not present. I would start feeling, if I got lost, I'd feel a variety of different kinds of tensions in my body. I'd get contracted often. And that was interesting, very useful to see, to be able to distinguish between a relaxed body and a tense body. And that was also part of the guide, and that relaxed body, that's the direction to go, not the tense body. I found it very fascinating to notice that when I get caught up in my thoughts, if I pay attention to what that's like, what is it like to be preoccupied in my thoughts? It actually feels like a darkening and a narrowing, like the mind gets narrower, the focus of attention gets narrow and tight and dark. And when I finally wake up and I'm mindful, in contrast, it feels like it's very light. And both light as weight, but also light as luminous, and expansive and open. Lost in thought kind of feeling is kind of like you're bounded. To be really mindful, it feels like it's boundless. And that to be able to distinguish between those two feelings, those two states of being, is a guide and a support to know, the onward leading is in the expansive state. Oh, now I'm not expansive. I know, I recognize what's happening now. And so it's not so much in, it can be, but in terms of the domain of the practice itself, it has a lot to do with how you are, not so much what you're looking at. What you're looking at is important, but what you're focusing, like the breathing, but how you are. So can you distinguish the different ways of how you are so you know what is a useful how and what is not a useful how? It might be for you that a useful how is just to be present and not try to do anything more than be present. It could be a useful how is to have a sense there is a direction here towards freedom. I can smell it. I have a feeling, I can intuit what that direction to letting go and real freedom is. I know that, and that moving in that direction, that's what's useful for me. And so the how we are, the direction we go, the state of mind that we have as we do the practice, that I know the difference between being mindful and being mindless. I know the difference between being connected to my experience and not connected. I know the difference between being settled and not settled. And making these very simple distinctions kind of can show us the path, show us where the onward leading is to freedom. So it kind of encourages an inspiration and encouragement to become our own teacher and find our own way. The third factor of awakening is energy or effort. And it isn't so much like we bear down and try harder, but it's a lot of it has to do with releasing the vitality that we have. There's a certain kind of release of vitality, of good energy that happens when we're no longer preoccupied, no longer attached and caught up in the hindrances. Hindrances can take a lot of time and effort. Being anxious can take a lot of energy and time. Having a really good resentment is exhausting, you know. And so, you know, but to become free of these preoccupations releases energy, releases a kind of vitality, and be able to distinguish the second factor of awakening between an energy that feels freeing, feels expansive, feels like it's flowing, feels like it's, you know, like life is living through us, versus an energy that feels like we're caught or we're bottled up or we're, you know, banging against a wall or we're, you know, contracted in some way, limited. Or the energy maybe is very energetic, but it really feels agitating. And we see the difference between a kind of vitality that's peaceful, that's very vital, and a kind of vitality that's agitating and irritating. The metaphor for meditative energy is that of a candle flame when there's no wind. A candle, a flame is really dynamic. I mean, but from the outside, it can look like it's completely still. So there's a stillness in being dynamic. So, to notice our energy and vitality, the factor of awakening, of engagement. I love the word engagement. And so the idea, let's really, really give myself to this, be wholehearted. So what's the wholeheartedness? I'm in. And it took me a long time in meditation to decide that I was really in. I was really, you know, in it, really here to do it. You know, I thought it was a good idea. But, you know, yeah, I think I'll do it. I'll sit here. Now, that was good. A little more relaxed than I was before. I think I'll come back. But I wasn't really in it. I was still in my other, you know, things that I was concerned with and plans and girlfriends and other good things. But to really, okay, I'm here. This is serious. This is like one of the most serious things you can do. But as Suzuki Roshi says in the kitchen here, you know, it's so important what we're doing. Don't take it too seriously. But it's really serious. This is like one of the great things you can do with a life. It's very meaningful, very powerful. It's a gift to the world. Some people have to do this work to really plumb into the depths of our being, work through all these complex, difficult kind of psychologies we have, and find freedom to some degree to show, demonstrate there's a path to walk, there's a path to follow, to just to other people to know that people are practicing is inspiring, for people to know there are people who are really making progress in practice and being changed and transformed gives people hope, gives people a possibility to do something different than to live in the way that people are so preoccupied and lost and in this world of ours, hurting each other. And so, you know, to be fully in and then be able to distinguish between how to be fully in, how to have good energy, really dedicate ourselves and not strive, not, you know, stray, not have to, not live with the expectations it's supposed to be, and not keep looking at your watch and say, am I there yet? Am I there yet? You know, why, you know, how long is it going to take here? To be able to distinguish between the value of patience, infinite patience, and being impatient, to recognize that. And then there's the factor of awakening that is joy. it's hard to, it's kind of surprising how much the Buddha, when he teaches meditation, is emphasizing joy. I think he expected it to be a happy process. And it can be. It's part of the boat. It's part of the onward leading. And where do you find joy in practice? There's a few different places. Maybe it's, unique to certain personalities, like mine. I just find it joyful to have the practice to do. I feel so fortunate. So I feel grateful. I feel inspired. Even when I don't practice well, I'm so inspired that I have a practice. I feel, where? How did I have such good fortune to have come across this? And how this good fortune to have people to practice with? And it's just like, this is good. The Buddha seems to think that if we lived a basic ethical life, that would bring joy. You'd feel kind of happy and delighted with yourself. He seemed to believe that if you had strong faith in the practice and the possibility of practice and faith in the teachers, like himself, that that could also bring a kind of light and joy and happiness that's inspiring. And the Buddha said that one of the sources of joy is to not have your mind hijacked by the pirates. When the pirates come and they take over, that's usually not a good thing. And some people, their ship has been taken over by the pirates for a long, long time. The pirates of desire, the pirates of ill will, the pirates of sloth and torpor, the pirates of restlessness and regrets, and the pirates of doubt. And to finally be free of those pirates, to not be constantly hijacked, and finally to feel somehow settled here. Feel like it's like becoming feel natural to be present here. The Buddha seemed to think that that was a source of great delight. He talked about it being a source of gladness, joy, and happiness. Or actually, actually more, source of gladness, joy, tranquility. I get it, but I'll do it really right, for the sake, rhetorical sake of repeating and making the point. Gladness, joy, physical tranquility, happiness, samadhi. So to begin recognizing, this is the discrimination of states, the discernment, distinguishing of states, which is investigation, to be able to pick up and recognize where there is some kind of present moment well-being, some kind of joy, some kind of lightness, some kind of delight, some kind of happiness. It doesn't have to be whistles and bells and really big. It's possible, even in states of misery, to walk outside and see a woodpecker and feel for a moment a certain kind of delight in the woodpecker. It's possible to go and enjoy this and have some kind of pleasure in some of the food, needing it. It's possible to feel a little delight in watching someone else practice. Look at that. That person is really in it. That, I could tell that person has a lot of difficulties. It's really struggling. But boy, that person's really sincere. Wow, that can bring, a little sliver. Or maybe there's a little sliver, a little crack someplace. It feels good to be present with my difficulties. I've been able to distinguish what it's like to be have difficulties and not really be mindful of it. Kind of know I'm having it, but really have sunk into it. Versus, I know what it's like to really bring mindfulness. There's a goodness or a rightness to really being present for the difficulties in a mindful way. And that can bring a little bit of joy. That little bit of joy can grow and develop and and you know, and really feel like you're in the flow, you're actually moving along. You're really in the boat. You've managed to get in the boat and you've released it from the dock. So it could finally go. You know, you feel like, I'm really here, we're moving here. And some of this joy that can happen is not for, it doesn't seem like it's for any good reason. It's just that the upwelling, freeing of energy, the upwelling of this good, clean, wonderful energy in the system. In the system, meaning the body. And one of the reasons to really live in this boat of your body is that the more you can be embodied, the more this flowing energy of freedom, what's being released, the engagement, can really kind of start kind of, that has no reason except that we're engaged and focused and concentrated, can begin to kind of flow. And then the fifth factor of awakening, the fifth factor of awakening is tranquility. And there's tranquility of the body, tranquility of the mind, relaxation of the mind, relaxation of the body, serenity, quietude. I don't know what kind of word we like to use, but it's such a pleasure to feel a physical, saturated feeling in the body of fullness, of ease, of peace, kind of like you're being washed from the inside out with, not just you don't feel the muscles relax, but you feel washed with a feeling of things are really tranquil. It's like an ocean of tranquility inside or through the body. The outer reaches of tranquility, it can be that dramatic. And it's a tranquility which, if all these factors are working together, it has no danger of putting you to sleep. Because of the energy, the clarity that's flowing there. It's like the tranquility of that candle flame. That's so still. And then there is concentration. And I think of concentration these days more in terms of unification than I do concentration. Concentration, for some of us in English, implies a kind of bearing down, a laser-like focus, kind of being in the control tower and kind of really staring your thing right in the eye and not wavering or something. But unification means a gathering together of all the pieces of who we are, including all of who we are, but without stopping for anything. It's keeping the ship going, but having everything unified, gathered together, going in the same direction at the same time. Summer I sailed across the Atlantic, one of the pleasures of it was that everything was going in the same direction. So the trade wind was going west, the currents were going west. There were all these jellyfish that would send up these little sails above the surface of the water. And they were going, the clouds were traveling west, these low, gray, very sweet clouds, kind of, they were kind of going west. Everything was going west. It was quite something. Everything was unified, everything was gathered together. So they have this kind of gather together, this unification, this everything flowing together, working together. We're not fragmented anymore. Our body, our emotional life, our motivational life, what we're trying to do, our mental life, our thoughts, to the degree to which we're still thinking a little bit, are all kind of there engaged in the same thing for the same purpose. Gather together here, to be here, attentive, present, like for the breathing or for this present moment experience. Yes, gather together. It's such a pleasure to be unified. It's such a pleasure to not be fragmented and being left astray. And then finally, it's the equanimity factor of awakening. it said that the equanimity factor is the one that keeps the other six factors in balance. The analogy it's given is a chariot being pulled by horses, maybe six horses, and when all the horses are pulling equally, then the chariot goes forward, you know, nicely. And the charioteer is the equanimity that's supposed to kind of keep them in balance, kind of. That's one analogy that's given. And so you're on your boat, sailboat, maybe going across the water, and the bow is cutting through, and you have six sails. And you want all the sails to be filled with wind. If one of them is not filled and flapping around, it doesn't work so well. So how do you fill your sails? How do you stay balanced? You stay balanced a lot by not taking it too personally. You take it balanced by not getting so involved in me, myself, and mine around this. My practice, my success, my going forward, my freedom out there. It doesn't quite work to say, I'm the one who's going to go over there and become free of self. The path there has to little bit replicate where the goal is. And if the goal is to really be freed of all self-centeredness, you got to start a little earlier. And so it's one of the ways that helps with equanimity is not to be so caught up and measure everything in terms of me, myself, and mine, and what's in it for me, and what's happening to me, and how I'm bad, or I'm good, or I'm this and that. This is one of the great things, you know, it's kind of like the other bumper sticker. You get a lot of bumper stickers in the Vipassana car. I don't stop for self. let that self thing just kind of wash off the hull of the boat and just kind of, you know. But, you know, it's so easy to stop for self. You know, it's... And so part of the equanimity for me is the equanimity as a factor of awakening is the equanimous continuity of practice, just holding the course, being steady, hold the course, and when something comes in the water, don't pick it up, don't push it away, don't stop, just hold the course, be steady, don't be reactive, don't turn the boat in a different direction towards whatever it's distracting you, or you don't have to pick everything up. You don't have to reject everything. Not rejecting doesn't mean you have to pick it up. Not picking up doesn't mean you have to reject. Just like everything just kind of wash off the hull. There might be a lot of protests about that's not really, Gil doesn't really understand what's going on with me. You know, what's really important. It's possible, it's true. And I want to be very respectful of how your practice is and what your needs are. But I do want to offer something, a perspective, is that you can have lots more time after the retreat to do it a different way. Here, it's really unique opportunity to just let everything just, as much as you can, just let it just wash off the hull, stay on track. And so the function of equanimity is that ability to keep going, holding the course, and not react to what comes along. Just keep your balance. Not to lose your balance because you dropped the plate of soup on the floor. Imagine, look at that. I wonder how the factors of awakening are operating now. Let's take 15 seconds to do a factor of awakening check before I clean up. Because Gil told me, you don't have to clean up right away. You're given a little bit of time to practice with what's happened. So that would be an example of, holding the course, not getting sidetracked, not stopping for something which in conventional world is an accident. But there's the equanimity factor is that which kind of keeps you equanimous, keeps you balanced, keeps you non-reactive, keeps you non-grasping, non-distracted by all the different things that can come your way, all the different thoughts your mind can produce. Hold the course. Hold the course. Keep your boat going. It's onward leading. Stay here. It's onward leading into the next moment. Into the next moment. Into the next moment. Once someone asked me, Gil, what is the self? Maybe they knew Buddhism has those funny teachings about the self. So what is the self? And I said, it's wind drag. It's what slows the boat down. I guess wind, you know, so just hold the course. Can you evoke the equanimity factor of awakening? Can you evoke, can you give rise to, can you muster, can you choose to bring forth even just a little bit, maybe even for 3 seconds at a time, hold the course and don't let anything else distract you? Or if not, maybe if you can do more than 3 seconds, do 3 breaths. I call it the 3-breath journey. Don't underestimate the tremendous value of a 3-breath journey. Can you, for 3 breaths, hold the course, keep the boat, stay on the breath, let whatever wants to come in wash off the hull, wash off the hull. It's not denying there's all kinds of things there, but you're not picking it up. 3 breaths, you're going to stay equanimous. 3 breaths, you're not going to react, be upset, push away, want. Try to be balanced. Still. This onward leading. You know, these metaphors have to come together. Like the flame, the completely still flame and so dynamic. The onward leading and completely still. Quiet. And you know it's onward leading on this path if the thinking mind is getting quieter. If the thinking mind is no longer thinking about things that are outside of the practice and what's happening in the moment. If the thinking mind is getting softer and thinner and weaker, and there's a kind of clarity or that kind of wells up around whatever little thoughts that are left, and the thoughts are not no longer the captain of the boat. And perhaps equanimity can be the captain for a while. Hold the course. Behold it steady. Hold it steady. Hold it steady. And it's remarkable how much can just be water off the bow. It makes practice a lot easier. Just water off the bow. Keep going into the next moment. Thank you.